ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
With the ongoing calamity of the Israel-Hamas war, we hear the word Gaza, of course, a lot. The Gaza Strip and the West Bank are two Palestinian territories that were part of mandated Palestine, captured by Israel during the Six-Day War in 1967. Many of you might have wondered why you often see the term Gaza in Australian contexts. For example, there are Gaza streets and Gaza roads across Australia's suburbs and towns. In Anzac Day parades, there are banners with Gazan locations embroidered across them, along with the names of famous Australian regiments. There are locations of battles where Australians fought, the names of which could be taken out of today's headlines. Australians took part in three battles in Gaza, two defeats in March and April 1917, and then the famous turning of the line at Beersheba in late October 1917, the famous charge of the Light Horsemen, which has gone into myth and memory. And indeed, the Gaza beachfront once held surf parades and carnivals, and they were held by, yes, Australian troops. All these linkages are curious and fascinating, and to explain and talk more about them, the linkages between Australian troops and Gaza and their Palestinian surrounds, we're joined by Michael Kelly, historian with the Australian War Memorial's Military History Section. Michael, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you very much for having me on.
It's a rich and fascinating corner of Australia's military engagement, this, isn't it?
It really is, because we've had significant presence there over the during the several months of the First World War, and also during the Second as well.
Yeah, that's right. Let's start with World War One. Why were Australians sent to Palestine? What was the status of Palestine in 1914 anyway?
The status of Palestine in 1914 was that it was part of the Ottoman Empire. Hmm. And the Australian troops didn't initially get to Gaza until 1917, but they had gone to Gallipoli in 1915, and after withdrawing, the Australian infantry and major artillery units had gone off to the Western Front, and the Light Horse had stayed in Egypt and then worked their way across Palestine as part of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, driving the Ottomans back out of away from the Suez Canal, ostensibly, clearing the Sinai so that the Ottomans couldn't threaten Egypt again, and then clearing the Ottomans from Palestine as well. So it was a campaign designed to push the Ottomans away from Egypt and the British interests around Suez.
That's right. It was essentially the clearing out of the Turks, wasn't it? The Ottomans, as it were.
Yeah.
From that part of the Middle East. And of course, that was all part of Britain's interests, because they wanted to recapture it. And Australians were serving as part of the British-led Egyptian Expeditionary Force, I think, wasn't it called the EFF?
EEF, yes. Yeah,
run by Archibald Murray, and after Second Gaza by Edmund the Bull Allenby.
Most definitely.
One of the most successful Allied generals of the First World War. Tell me about those.
Yeah, Murray ran his campaign from Cairo, so he really didn't get anywhere near the front line. And he sent some fairly loose reports about his successes or lack of success at during the battles of Gaza, which brought him undone after the Second Battle of Gaza was such an absolute disaster for the Expeditionary Force and the Royal British Infantry and Australian Light Horsemen as well. And once Bull Allenby was brought over, he actually was relieve of command in after the Arras campaign in April 1917, and was sent to Egypt to reinvigorate the command there. And after he arrived, he actually found out that the week he arrived, his only son Michael was killed on the Western Front, and he took a little bit of time to grieve and then got on with the campaign, basically reinvigorating all the troops under his command and trying to give them victories.
So how many Australians were there under arms?
Oh, good question. There's a number of Light Horse regiments. So basically, you've got tens of thousands of Australians, I'll put it in that regard, serving in the desert, and thousands more serving on the Western Front. So it's a much smaller campaign, but it's still one that's a lot of romance has grown up around and a lot of myth and interest as well.
So. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, there were the two defeats in March and April 1917. Australian soldiers were killed there.
Very much so. There's a number of Australians killed during First and Second Gaza. One of the stories that we don't really hear much about is the Australians who are serving in the Imperial Camel Corps. The Australians there took the ICC weren't as mobile as the Light Horsemen were. Light Horsemen were more the hit and run sort of troops, whereas the camel troops were dismounted fighters, sort of infantry style. And once they were engaged, they were hard to disengage. So they were taking on one of the Ottoman redoubts there and suffered extremely heavy casualties during that second battle of Gaza. And so there was that that involvement there.
The action's ultimately successful, isn't it? I mean, part of the success is one of the Australian military's most famous actions. It's steeped in romance and myth, I suppose. but for heaven's sake, what on earth are we doing in the First World War in the age of the machine gun, having cavalry charges, for heaven's sake? But we did. The Australian Light Horsemen launched a desperate mounted raid against Turkish forces to take the desert city of Beersheba. Where's Beersheba's now in Israel, isn't it?
Yes,
but
it
then
is.
It was part of Palestine.
Yes, yeah, it was out at the extreme right flank of the Egyptian Expeditionary Forces line at that time, and so Allenby had actually sent Chauvel's forces out that way to try and turn the flank, which they ultimately did. And it was actually as the charge was going in, they had attached British artillery batteries that were able to take on and neutralise a lot of the Ottoman machine gun positions on the way in. So it actually helped the Light Horsemen get purchase on their attack and ultimately succeed.
Yes, I mean, that's right. There's a lot of talk, isn't there, of the way that the Turks had sighted their guns and whether they were firing over the heads of the Australians by... for all sorts of reasons as well. How important were the horsemen themselves, do you think, as opposed to artillery and machine guns in that fight?
I think the horsemen gave that level of surprise and able to advance really quickly, which stopped the Ottomans from dropping their gun sights too quickly as well. So the light horse were able to advance in under those guns rapidly. Whereas if you're, as infantry, if you're trying to fight your way forwards, you get a lot more gunfire and artillery and things like that being brought upon you, which would slow you up. So the mounted action was actually quite successful because of the speed that it went in. But there was a lot of preparation work done by other light horse units fighting and taking hills around them to let that attack go through.
Yeah, it was a pivotal battle, wasn't it? The line was turned at Beersheba, and by the middle of December, the Egyptian expeditionary force was in Damascus.
No, they were in Jerusalem.
Okay.
Yeah, they'd actually advanced by the 9th of December, 1917, had taken Damascus. And that was the British Prime Minister at the time, Lloyd George, had said, I'd like that as a Christmas present. And Allenby got it for him several weeks early.
Yeah. What was the position of Australia? There were some, I mean, the Australians were in an odd position there, weren't they? I mean, there was a much greater sense of them being in touch with religion and history, perhaps, than there is the case today. I mean, there is some suggestion they were talked of amongst locals as being modern crusaders, for example. Was that so?
The Australians were a little uncomfortable with those sort of terms, I guess, being labelled as crusaders, and you can see that in some of their diaries. They are certainly aware of the biblical ground they're going across, and also the history that has preceded them. I mean, you've got men talking about the Egyptian Empire and the rise of the Egyptian Empire through that region, plus the Richard III and his crusade through the area as well. And so I think that's where the crusade analogy came from, is they're sort of the next lot of Richard III's and the British troops coming through. But I mean, there's certainly campaign analogies to be drawn between looking at the Egyptians and the old English sort of campaigns of those ancient times. But the Australians in that period of time were a lot more in touch with the religion. The Catholics, Protestants, and whichever other religions they were the main two in Australia at that time. But it was a lot more. We were a lot more God-fearing, I think, at that stage. So the Australians certainly knew the biblical nature of the ground they were walking and fighting over. But they certainly weren't comfortable with that crusader analogy or comparison.
No, I'm talking with Michael Kelly, historian at the Australian War Memorial, and we're talking about the connection of Australian troops with Gaza and the Palestinian mandated territories. Of course, that's right. By the end of the First World War, the Ottoman Turks have been driven out of Palestine. Then it becomes British mandated Palestine. Then all the way through to the Second World War, again, when there are strong Australian links here, aren't there? I mean, Australian troops get sent to Palestine rather than Egypt. Why were they sent there?
Very much so. Initially, the Egyptian government had, people there had a lot of long memories, so the Australians hadn't exactly covered themselves in glory in 1914 and 15 with some of their behaviours in Cairo and surrounds. Mm. So when they went back to the Middle East in the Second World War, and some of the same men had gone back for a second time, but also their sons, they were sent to Palestine instead because the Egyptian government thought, well, we've had the Australians here once before and we don't want a repeat of the experience. So off they went up to Gaza and the surrounds up there where they trained and prepared and got ready to fight.
So they were in that territory that we now know as Gaza today, were they?
Yes, yeah. And they were there for quite some time. And you see a lot of hospitals, the main infantry units were there as well. And you see a lot of sporting carnivals being held because men have got to relieve the boredom somehow. And
sure. But this was that they were there as kind of staging post for dispatch elsewhere in the in the Second World War theatre of war, were they?
Yes, you see the 7th Division going up in north to fight the Vichy French,
yeah.
And also the other troops being going over to the desert to fight the Germans and the Italians as well. So it's very much a staging post. Gaza's got a deep water port, so that there's hospital ships and other ships being able to come in and supply and bring troops in and drop them off as well. And all those sort of port cities along the coastline there were very vital.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's some really interesting photographs. There's a photograph of a life ring with Australian Light Horse initials on it and the term Palestine Surf Club, and yes, photos of Australians in swimming gear at the beaches. And as you say, there was a hospital set up at Gaza and a swimming parade was held on the coast near Khan Yunis in April 1907, in April by the 1st Light Horse Regiment as well.
Yes, yeah, that swimming ring is it's a wag. Some wag has actually painted the Palestine Surf Club on it, but they actually went anywhere near Gaza at that stage. They were just out from Khan Yunis along the coast there, so they'd held a swimming event there or a swimming parade there in early April 1917 before they went up to do some garrison duties. So this is in between the Gaza battles, so they've actually having a bit of time to have a bit of relaxing before they go back to the campaign. So they're only there for a couple of days, but then they're going north into the desert again. So it's the Second World War, you certainly see because they're there for a lot longer, activities that are structured by the Australian forces, and they've actually got soldiers in uniform who were lifeguards back at home. And you see some great photographs in the newspapers at the time of lifeguards who'd been lifeguards at Bondi and they're running surf events at Gaza. And they're also doing a lot of surf rescue as well because Australians being Australians manage to get themselves into trouble wherever there's water. So these men are well employed and surf rescue as well.
Yeah, of course, as we mentioned, I mean, there are Australian war graves in Gaza, aren't there? I mean, these are managed, I presume, are they, by the Australian War Graves Commission?
By the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Yeah. There's some 259 Australians, I believe, buried in the Gaza Cemetery. Right. And I think there's over 2,500 burials, Allied burials and German burials there as well. So there's quite a mixed bag of burials in the Gaza Cemetery. And 259 Australians, about 97, I think it is, from the First World War, and the rest from the Second. So it was quite populated by Australians.
It's funny the connections that Australians make, don't they, around the world. Of course, as we know, historically Australian troops were pulled out of the Middle East and Europe for the second part of the Second World War for the protection of Australia. But after the war, the Anzac marches and the like, I mean, there was... Was there a bond, do you think, between the Palestinian locations and Australians?
You can certainly see that with the naming of streets, suburbs, even buildings. There's certainly an affinity with the men and women who served over there to bring back their memories and the naming conventions, I think you'd say, for those streets, buildings and towns around Australia.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not as far away from us as we think sometimes.
Not at all.
And that's the thing with Australian troops, which have always been keeping these connections close. Michael, it's been fascinating to talk with you.
Philip, thank you so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.